Support for Talking Art on WVIK comes from the people at Quad City Bank and Trust, helping the local community with their banking and financial needs for more than 20 years. Information is at qcbt.com. Support also comes from the estate of Margaret Skinner, a longtime friend of WVIK and lover of the arts.
This is Carolyn Martin, and I'm talking art today with Andrew Wallace, Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Figge Art Museum, about the William L. Hawkins, an imaginative geography exhibit that is currently on display. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming today. You know, there's been so much talk about the current French Modern exhibit that it's important for visitors to know that they will also see a knockout show of a very different nature when they go to see the French master's work. How would you describe William Hawkins' art?
Well, he is considered a folk artist, and for me, this idea or the construct of folk art sort of expanded when I saw an exhibition or a collection of work that came to the Smithsonian's American Art Museum in the late 1980s. That collection expanded the idea of what traditional folk art was considered to be, and in particular, the way in which artists made work and the materials that they used to make it.
Mm-hmm. His work is, when you walk in, you see it immediately, and there's kind of like a little prelude or a short introduction to his work when you first come into the giant foyer at the Figge. Right by the main elevator, there is some of his work, though the majority of the exhibit is up on the fourth floor, and it you see it immediately, and I think most people kind of stop in their tracks when they see it.
Sure, and I hope so. That section, that first section that introduces you to Hawkins' work is largely comprised of the sort of the architectural scenes. That was one of the major themes of Hawkins' work. And so he was principally interested in looking at the buildings that were being built and around downtown Columbus. And
that's Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio, yes. And he painted those because he was interested in them, and he referred to them as these giant temples. And then his approach to painting them often incorporated the use of non-traditional colors just to liven them up and make them more exciting.
Mm-hmm. They are so lively. And they're large. The colors are very, very vivid and brilliant. He uses a lot of collage and assemblage, which is interesting.
Yes. Yeah, and that's one of the things that is discussed in the catalog and certainly in the exhibition. His use of imagery from the magazines and calendars and whatnot that he collected to use and to reuse often inspired the subject matter of his works, particularly the animals and the exotic creatures that he pictures, but also too the imagery of the Last Suppers, which was a major series of works for him, something that he was interested in exploring, and the four of the eight that are shown at the Figge incorporate collage in many entertaining and interesting and innovative ways. One of the things that's important about knowing about Hawkins, his work, was that he had a good handle on the types of materials that he had collected. And so when he was working on a particular piece, he could reach into his suitcase, which he called his research, and grab something that he felt was particularly appropriate for that particular piece, whether it was a set of eyes, a model's, you know, maybe a heavily lashed set of a woman's eyes, or maybe it was a scene, maybe a picture of a sculpture, or in many cases there are images of buildings that belong to the Smithsonian Institution, and that is partly owed to the fact that one of the magazines that he often used was Smithsonian Magazine.
Yeah, what it's just so interesting. So he used a lot of he loved magazines. He loved pictures in general. He would cut out portions of those or an entire page and then use some of that in his paintings. And they're very small portions of it, but they really pop out. Like you alluded to the animals that he was painting. He will sometimes have then human eyes that he's cut out and placed on the larger animal.
My favorite is the Philadelphia Museum's Matador, and I'm forgetting the name, but Matador with a bull, and the bull has clearly feminine eyes and eyelashes collaged onto it. So you have this, and I'm sure that he chuckled to himself when he chose to do that, but it's very effective and it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see the collage a lot in the animals and then his religious subjects in the cityscapes, and he did a lot of those, like
yes.
the foyer area. When you first walk in, it's mainly cityscapes, and mm-hmm. and then that's there's less collage within those.
Yes, and in those primarily he was interested in the buildings, these fine temples. And some of them are older structures that have long since been torn down, such as the Union Station image. But then there's the Verne Riff Government Center, of which there are several examples, which is a prominent fixture in downtown Columbus, Ohio, right across from the state capitol. So it's really, it was something that inspired him and sort of man's ingenuity. And certainly that is what is important to his art, is being inspired by imagery or by personal experience and incorporating that into what he did. And of course he was 86 or 85 when he was discovered in 1981, and he lived a very productive almost 10 years of producing art, largely because his work had been drawn to the attention of collectors and gallerists mm-hmm. who saw an opportunity to share his art more widely.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned his age, and we should talk about that because it's really, really amazing. He was born in 1895, and he paints that almost all of his pictures, which is so funny. He writes born in 1895 in Kentucky or something like
yes,
that, and it's literally part of his signature.
July 27, yeah. so there's two elements to that story, as I understand it. One is that he wanted to make sure that people understood who had created the works. The second was that he was aware of people, unscrupulous people, stealing or copying the works of other artists. And there were several other self-taught artists working in Columbus with whom he was familiar. And he wanted to make sure that his work was not stolen and that everybody could attribute it properly to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit more about his life, because his art, in a way, reflects his life. The accumulation of our experiences do, it usually comes out in our art. It's displayed. We can't ignore our past experience. So he was born in 1895 in Kentucky.
That's correct, in Eastern Kentucky, and I didn't know anything about him as a man or his background or his race when I first saw his work, but I was immediately drawn to it. And I think it is that connection with his past and his experience, which he invests in his work, which is quite interesting. And of course, this is not something that's exclusive to Hawkins. It's something that is a part of every artist. In fact, the artists we're showing now at the museum, whether it's John Bloom or the French Moderns, they are all infusing in their work their wealth of experience, and that's pretty clear in Hawkins' mm-hmm. work.
Yeah, because he was raised on this farm, and Kentucky's known for their horses, and so he had he actually trained horses, so he his animal subjects probably reflect that in a way.
Yeah, and I think they do.
And love of them.
Yes, and when he was interviewed by Gary Schwindler, who's there's an essay by him in the catalog for the exhibition. But Gary Schwindler did some extensive interviews with Hawkins and was able to get to the bottom of his inspiration. And certainly, growing up on this farm until his mid-teens, he had the luxury, unusual for the time, of being in this rich and wonderful place and having a supportive family and also working very hard, probably with the idea that at some point he would also be a farmer or raise animals. But it was clearly in his conversations with Gary Schwindler something that was near and dear to him. And certainly it's the evidence of that is borne out by mm-hmm. viewing his works.
Yeah. Gary Schwindler was his biographer.
Right.
And then William Hawkins moved to Columbus when he was a young man at around
yes.
the age of 21.
Right. So he was always an industrious person. That's clear, too, in his art and the way he takes and uses found materials to create what he creates. And he lived a long, obviously long and good life, not very wealthy, of course, given the trials and tribulations of being a black man in 1920s and et cetera, Columbus, Ohio. But he persevered and he made a living in all the ways that he could, from driving trucks to painting signs to building homes. So he really sort of thrived in his modest way. And I think all that, too, comes out through his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one, there's so many aspects of the story I think are fascinating. But one to me is that he was, it was quite late in his life when he enjoyed the success
yes.
from his artwork. And he was largely unknown until 1982. So what, sure. what happened in that year?
So, well, just prior to 1982, he was befriended by a young man named Lee Garrett, who had just gone through the Ohio State University art program. And I believe he'd gotten an MFA in sculpture. He was befriended by Garrett. Garrett was impressed immediately after meeting him and seeing the work that he was creating, that Garrett felt that he should advertise Hawkins and his work more widely. His work was submitted to the Ohio State Fair amateur art competition, and for which two of the works, I believe, won prizes. And one work in particular was purchased then by the juror of that competition, a man named Robert Natkin, who is an abstract painter from New York. So with that, there's clearly Hawkins is enjoying the attention that's being paid to his work. And then incentive is given to him to continue that and perhaps even ramp up his production because he wanted to sell works. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a part of his personality, his background, doing whatever he could to make money to get along.
Yeah.
But the beauty of that, of course, is that it inspired him to just create. And he created things that he felt would be interesting to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the book, if not all of the pieces in the exhibit right now, were produced during this stage in his life. So he
yes.
was in his very late 80s to early 90s, which is just amazing.
It is amazing, but it's a sort of a testament and sort of representative of his life, mm-hmm. Being industrious and being resourceful and in many ways being practical and making do with what you have.
Yeah. Before he was discovered, if you will, I know he was painting, he was using some just paint that he found, and he mm-hmm. was painting on other objects that he could just find and secure. But then after Lee Garrett befriended him, he started using these larger masonite panels.
Yes, and as the story goes, Lee Garrett wanted to support him. And obviously, you can't always find the right materials when you're scavenging. Say, for instance, you can't always find perfectly shaped pieces of plywood or masonite, for that matter. So Lee was pre-cutting masonite for him. Sometimes as many as 4 by 8 feet, as large as 4 by 8 feet. And so Hawkins took full advantage of that and created some amazing works, whether it was found material or material provided by Lee Garrett at that time. And so it really allowed him to blossom and his work to blossom. And yes, late in life, but there are many people who are highly productive late in their lives, more so than the first half of their life. So that's not unusual. But what is, I think, beautiful about the story is that he was able to thrive and create work that made him happy to create, but more than that, be able to then sell to somebody else who would be even more happy to own it.
Mm-hmm. Besides his use of found objects, one thing I loved is the way he created depth and the specific material that he used to do that on some of his paintings.
Yes, the cornmeal that he incorporated into his paint, as the story goes again, Lee Garrett had been using sand in his own works, and perhaps a lack of sand encouraged Hawkins to incorporate cornmeal. And one of the things I think that is interesting to me is that, so when I was working for the Smithsonian, I had friends who were artists, and they were also inspired by this collection of folk art, and in particular the way, the innovative use of materials. Regardless of whether the artists were self-taught or not, they were always exploring and always innovating in small ways. And maybe not the Hawkins was maybe not the first person to incorporate cornstarch, but his use of cornstarch inspired friends of mine.
Cornmeal.
His use of cornmeal inspired my friends to try, who were artists, to incorporate that into their work. So,
well, it's very effective.
It is, and it's
and there's this textural element to it.
There is a textural element, and it works very well. And obviously it was a success for Hawkins. And so I think that's one of the wonderful things about art, is that it can inspire both the people who view it, but other artists to take up these ideas and explore them and produce even more work.
Mm-hmm. Besides his animal figures and his cityscapes, you have this really incredible series of Last Supper works created by him. And I believe 8 of the 9 that are out there somewhere you've amassed in this exhibit.
We have, and we're very fortunate. They've come from all over. And so we're able to share those with everybody. And I think the important thing is that you're able to look at them and see the many ways in which he sort of explored or wrestled with or discarded earlier ideas in the creation of new versions of the Last Supper. I believe the original Last Supper that he was looking at was not Leonardo's, but he was looking at essentially a Last Supper on black velvet. which inspired him and his...
So a little non-traditional sure, and, view of the Last Supper.
Right. And so he was trying to outdo that. And so he was using that as his model, and he was doing great things, mm-hmm. I think.
He uses a lot of collage in those.
He uses a lot of collage in the last four. So the four most recent of the 8 that appear at the Figge have collage in them. My favorite being that the face of Jesus is Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder, the musician.
Yeah.
And he also has little collage pieces of their food on the table.
And they're straight out of a Stouffer's frozen food commercial or advertisement.
Yeah. Tell us, what's the meaning behind the exhibit's subtitle? And that's an imaginative geography.
The subtitle comes from an essay that Gary Schwindler had written in 1989 for the Rico Maresca catalog of Hawkins' work. As Susan Crawley, who was the exhibition curator, and I wrestled with the idea of what we were going to call the exhibition and, of course, the attendant catalog, I had been reading and rereading many of the essays and articles that have been written about Hawkins' work, and I had come across the imaginative geography.
So that was a phrase that
Schwindler had used, that he had mm-hmm. coined. And that's reflective of essentially the experience, Hawkins' experience, and of course, with experience, you are able in many ways to be much more imaginative than you would be without. So that's sort of the subtext. But Schwindler is sort of summing up Hawkins' experience within this phrase, an imaginative mm-hmm. geography.
So within the geography, meaning reflecting like the places he knew well.
Sure.
The farm in Kentucky, his beloved Columbus, Ohio, and then just twisting it, adding his own imagination.
Yeah, the topography of his imagination, if you will. So that landscape, which is sort of internal in his memory.
Mm-hmm. There's this display case in the exhibit that contains some personal items of Hawkins inside. And you'd mentioned
sure.
earlier his infamous suitcase, which is like very battered. And describe again what he kept inside, because that's such a
yes,
really lovely part of the story too.
He kept his newspaper and magazine and article clippings in the suitcase. And he would, and there's a film that was made about William Hawkins in 1987, which is a portion of which is available on YouTube, directed and produced by Jeffrey Wolfe. where Hawkins is sifting through and explaining to the people who are filming him and speaking to him about how he goes about the process and is grabbing, and this is where he grabs material for specific use in the work that he's working on in mm-hmm. front of the camera. And it's, so it's that sort of awareness of his materials and how he wants to use them that is sort of common to artists. You create an inventory of materials, and when you are creating a work, you know exactly what you want to do, and you know exactly where your resources are, and you employ them in the way that you see fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just really fun that he kept them all mm-hmm. all together in this space, in this suitcase which you've acquired. We talked earlier about the term folk art, and Hawkins is a self-taught artist. You had mentioned earlier too that this opened up the box of possibilities for him creatively.
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly when you look at the history of art, just generally speaking, the advent of photography in the 19th century sort of did away with this idea that artists had to create meticulous copies of nature. Why paint it if a photograph can do it just as well? And then with the advent of Dada and that sort of thing, you have the idea of what art can be has just exploded. So when we look at Hawkins and we look at this term of folk art or self-taught art, we now are open to interpretation as to what that can mean and what that can be. And the analogy that I like to make is I think about, having been a musician myself, I think about artists who have that urge to create, musicians in particular, or writers too, who they just do it. They just get to work and they do it, whether it's in their garage or their basement. They grab a guitar or a bass, or they put pencil to paper and start writing, and they create. And we don't say, for instance, we don't point at Bruce Springsteen and say, oh, he's self-taught, and then somehow diminish him as an artist because of that. Mm-hmm. And history is full of great examples of people who essentially are self-taught. Ernest Hemingway, with all his faults, he taught himself how to write, and that was enormously influential on 20th century literature. Similarly, and I like to think of the punk movement, in particular, the progenitors, bands like Television and Richard Hell and the Voidoids, as being these young people who haven't even gone to college, but who have this creative impulse, and they put that all together to create something that's new and different. And so we can accept that in music, but for whatever reason in academia, we have a harder time accepting that in visual art. But there's a quote in Richard Hell's book, which is a relatively recent book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp is the title of it. But he's talking about Robert Quine, who was a guitarist in his band, the Voidoids. But I think it sums up how we feel about artists like William Hawkins, which is to say, it was the depth of feeling, and this is the quote, it was the depth of feeling, not any pioneering explorations or any technical facility or any kind of academic sophistication that set him apart. And that, I think, sort of sums up that feeling you get when you look at a work of art, regardless of whether the artist is trained or from the academy or self-taught, it doesn't matter. There's usually some inner spark or spirit in that work that connects us with it mm-hmm. and keeps us interested.
Yeah, there's so much joy in his paintings. That's the emotion that I feel when I look at them. And when you were talking earlier, it reminded me actually of the academically trained artist and then the Impressionists.
Sure.
So it's actually, there's a great corollary with the French Modern exhibit, because a lot of those painters were considered crass, and they weren't felt to have any technique at all, and they were they were ridiculed as producing these terrible paintings, and so there is definitely a correlation.
Sure,
William Hawkins.
Yes, those artists were challenging the Academy in the way they used paint, and the paint was becoming. There was a taboo about using paint in a way that gave away the hand of the artist. There's a painting in the exhibition by Manet. It's a portrait of a young woman of the French Moderns exhibition, and I encourage listeners to go look at that painting and look at the way the eyes are painted, and then go look at some of the eyes that were painted by Hawkins in his exhibition. So there is a connection there. It's not necessarily one where Hawkins has studied art history, but the connection is that artists have all these opportunities within their imagination and in their arsenal to explore creating works of art. And if we limit that, then we're limiting our experience of the world, I think. And mm-hmm. so that connection between Hawkins and this eyes of this young girl in Manet's painting, I think, is quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go relook at that. Well, let's also talk about your personal role in bringing this exhibit together. You were the managing curator for this work, and
yes.
Describe what that entailed and how this came about.
So, as you might know, the Figge has a very small staff, and so we invited, as we discussed the possibility of doing a Hawkins exhibition, we invited the input from a number of gallerists and people who were familiar with Hawkins' work. And the name that came to the forefront was Susan Crawley. And at the time, Susan was the curator of folk art at the High Museum in Atlanta. So we had this possibility of working with this curator who's experienced in writing about folk art in particular, but had written other books on other folk artists. And so she had a great deal of perspective to bring to this project. And so that's kind of a critical element to any project like this, where you have somebody who has a depth of connection.
Mm-hmm. So she was the outside curator, but you actually organized
sure.
the show.
Sure. And so that involved us reaching out to Susan and inviting her to be the guest curator. And then from then, it was, okay, who else are we going to invite to participate in the creation of the catalog? Because we knew at the outset that we wanted to create a catalog. And the thing that was most important to me was that the images in the catalog be higher detail and show the work better than previous efforts had. And
so that was in terms of photographs.
In terms of the quality of the imagery, the quality of the color. And in particular, what is important to Hawkins is the detail of the surface texture, for instance, with the cornmeal
yeah.
and other materials that incorporated into these. So from that point, it was a matter of, once we had established who was going to help us with this project, is finding the works. So again, you reach out to a network of gallerists through Susan's connections and my connections and the museum's connections, and we try to identify where all these works are and how we can bring them together into an exhibition.
And they were gathered from across the U.S., but also Europe.
Yes,
yeah,
so there's
there.
We know, for instance, there's collectors of Hawkins' work in Japan, but not in this exhibition. But there are lenders from Switzerland and also England whose works are included in this exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the major part of the work that we do, is the logistical challenge of bringing these together. Reaching out to possible lenders and encouraging their support through the lending of these works. And then the burden is on us to take care of those works and shepherd them around, in this case, to four venues, including the Figge, around the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even though the Figge organized it was first displayed in Columbus, Ohio.
Sure.
I understand. And then where is it going after it leaves here?
Coincidentally, it's going to a place called Columbus, Georgia. Columbus Museum of Art in Columbus, Georgia will be the final venue for this. Part of creating a traveling exhibition like this is working with all the potential venue schedules. So in this case, the Minge International Museum, which was located in San Diego, which preceded the Figge as a venue, was planning on a physical renovation of their spaces. So in order to make the exhibition work with their schedule, we shifted things around.
I was mistaken then. It was in San Diego initially.
It was in Columbus, but we had to swap everybody's schedules around to make that happen. Oh. So we ended up with Columbus first, San Diego second, and the Figge third.
Uh-huh. And Tom Figge was also somewhat instrumental in starting this too.
Yes,
I understand he was really interested in Hawkins' work.
Tom Figge is very interested in Hawkins' work. So I hadn't thought about Hawkins for some time since I left the Smithsonian in the late 90s. And then I found a kindred spirit in Tom Figge and his interest in collecting Hawkins' work. And we were fortunate that he donated a major work to the Figge for our 10th anniversary in 2015. But Tom was that enthusiasm, that his approach, almost like a child, seeing these works and just being totally riveted and excited by them is similar to the experience I had when I first saw Hawkins' work back in the late 1980s in Washington. And that, I think, is sort of necessary to any exhibition project, is that you have supporters who are enthusiastic about mm-hmm. the work that you're going to do and are just as interested in it being a success as you are.
Yeah. Well, I'd read somewhere that William Hawkins had a persistent desire to overwhelm the viewer. And
yeah.
And that's really very descriptive, because that is, I think, what most people feel. Obviously, you felt that way.
Oh, certainly.
You've carried these images with you for a long time.
Yeah.
Then Tom Figge felt that same way. It's really impressive, and it's a nice counterbalance with the French moderns.
Oh, I think so. And one of the things we try very hard to do, or I do in my role at the Figge, is create an interesting mix of exhibitions and collection opportunities, and this, of course, serves our educational programming for our visitors, so that there's always something new, sometimes it's close to home, like John Bloom, and sometimes it's further afield, like French moderns, and then sometimes it's in the middle, it's like William Hawkins, mm-hmm. I think. But also, too, in each of those exhibitions, you find a variety of ways in which artists tackle subject matter, tackle the use of their materials, and exploit them to create the works that they want to create.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew Wallace, thank you so much for talking today and for your hard work to bring this really eye-opening and creative exhibit to our community.
You're very welcome.
William L. Hawkins, An Imaginative Geography, will be open through December 30th at the Figge Art Museum on the fourth floor. There's a free family day scheduled for Saturday, November 17th. And the Figge also offers free admission every Thursday evening from 5 to 9 p.m. Don't miss the chance to see this exhibit, which in its highly personal style is a perfect contrast to the French moderns. This has been Carolyn Martin, talking art in the Quad Cities for WVIK. Our theme music is provided by a Quad City legend, the late Ellis Kell.